shot, picked away by Hellebuck. Rebound in front of the net. Kamara scores! 5 seconds left in the power play. Johnny Capitan has given the Leafs a 1-0 lead. Looks for a man in front of the shot. His rebound scores! Marner is Johnny on the spot to deflect a rebound in behind Hellebuck. And the Maple Leafs have a 2-0 lead. Bjork over on the far side with a pass in front of the net. A shot scores! And Kyle Connor will get the Jets on the board. And it's 2-1. Played ahead for Marner. Empty net ahead of him. Game over! Played down into the corner. The Leafs will get it around back of the net. And time will run out.
Scott MacArthur, Hazel May, on Tuesday, January the 19th.
Good morning. I got up again. I'm always nervous about the alarm not going off.
So how do you do it?
On my phone, and then I have a backup. Mm-hmm. And then because, you know, I'm deathly afraid to be late, I get up probably every couple hours. I look over, it's 12:30. I look over, it's 1:30.
Oh, no, don't do that.
I know, but I'm trying. And yeah. I don't want to let you down, Scotty MacArthur.
Don't do that because you got to get your sleep. Just make sure you set multiple alarms.
Okay.
Because we've all had that moment in our lives where somehow, some way, we're convinced the alarm didn't go off.
Correct.
But we actually, in our sleep, probably reached over and turned it off.
Right. Are you a snooze button person?
Not on weekday mornings, but yeah. Yes, I definitely can be. So I set multiple alarms so that if I accidentally reach over and turn off the first one,
right,
the second one will go just a couple of minutes later. Like, I've got the protection mechanism in. And the other thing is if there are any impending software updates to your phone.
Oh, I never thought of that.
And you get that warning early morning or mid-morning of the day that your phone is going to update tonight.
Right, at 2 a.m. or something.
Make sure you do that while you're awake and on Wi-Fi, because then you don't want it to update in the middle of the night and have something go wrong and it doesn't come back on, and that's your alarm, and the alarm doesn't go off, and then, uh-oh.
That's very good. That's very good advice.
That's a hack anyway, obviously. I don't care if you're doing a morning show or if you got to get up and be at work for 7 a.m.
Right.
Doesn't really, it's a life hack anyway. Just don't put yourself in a position to, but I don't have any old school alarm clocks anymore.
Right.
Like, it's the ones that sit on the night table and it's all phones.
The digital, do you remember the digital ones where you just hit that middle large bar and you hit that about 3 or 4 times?
And you had the choice of whether the radio
came
on.
Yep.
Or the
buzzer, which was really annoying. It was that noise that definitely got you up.
All right. I want to wake up to the Beatles in the morning. I don't want to wake up to the simulated sound of a fire alarm. We got a huge show this morning.
I'm excited.
Like, an hour from now, 7 o'clock, Bob Costas.
The
Bob. There aren't many these.
These.
We should go through a list of people.
Okay.
Who deserve to have the in front of their name in pro sports. The Tom Brady.
That's a good one. The LeBron James.
Yes. The Mike Trout.
The Tiger Woods.
The Al Michaels.
Oh, that's a good one.
See, I think that's, so. You have to,
I really,
right?
Like,
legends,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I really like. Are we at that point where I can say the Joe Buck? Nah.
He's done a lot for a lot of years. He's going to be there.
The Jim Nance?
Yeah. There's something about Al Michaels. I don't know what it is. Is his voice? His voice is just, you know it when you hear it.
Yes.
I think you'd say the same for Joe Buck, but Al Michaels is so distinct.
Yes.
But you know what? Of all those people, and out of those people who have Twitter handles, they don't have the at the start of their Twitter
handle. I know where this is going. And that's only because...
But you can get Hazel on Twitter at the Hazel May.
Okay, so when I was, convinced to join Twitter, I punched in Hazel May. Who knew there's like 15 Hazel Mays? So I thought, well,
was there a,
I'm the Hazel
was
May.
There a fake Hazel May
yes.
account before a real Hazel May account? Somebody was impersonating you before the real you came on?
See, I mean, I don't have the trademark to the name Hazel, but I know there was, you know, Hazel May 43, H May 92734. But there was a parody account after I signed up. And unfortunately, that needed to be shut down because there was not so nice things on that one.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just literally thought, okay, the Hazel May. I know there are people that say the real blah, 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 blah as their handle. But I just thought I'd just keep it at the.
Yeah. Well, and the real has now been replaced by the actual check mark.
Correct.
Now, you can get yourself verified and then everybody knows it's you. That's why it doesn't matter if it's hockey, baseball, like use Ken Rosenthal as an example. Somebody always retweets Ken Rosenthal, right. The wrong Ken Rosenthal. And there are many not real Ken Rosenthals around baseball's trade deadline.
Mm-hmm. There's the Ken Rosenthal.
Right. There's an underscore yeah. or there's some kind of thing, an extra N at the end of Ken or whatever. And it ends up being retweeted by a reputable person. And you're looking at this going, holy crap. And it's the same. The avatar is the same. You uh-huh. know what you're looking for with Ken Rosenthal. But I always look now for the check mark. If I don't see the check mark, I'm not going to fall for it.
Have you fallen for one? I did one.
I have not, just because I've become obsessed with the check mark. Was it a good one? Was it a good story?
It was the Rosenthal.
Rosenthal. Yeah.
And it was his picture, and I was busy, and I just quickly looked, and it was a trade, and I hit send, and I was like, ah, Hayes, come on.
Yeah,
be
and
better.
Then you're pulling that down as quickly as possible, hoping that there weren't any likes or retweets or screen caps. Willie Nylander. Got a cop to this one. Willie Nylander scores 2 goals on opening night against Montreal.
Okay.
And you like, I'm just mush or something. So I go, Willie Nylander's on pace for 128 goals this season. Well, 56 times 2 is 112. It's not 128. So I quickly, okay, like what? And hi, Mrs. Bobker, my grade 11 math teacher would certainly verify this if she even remembers who I am. Like 56 times 2 is 128. Mrs. Bobker would go, that's Scott. But I screwed that up. And so I take down the tweet. I put up 56 times 2, 112. And then at the bottom, I joke, thank you for not screen capping.
See, but,
my mistake tweet,
but good
and then
on you.
And then I get 2 or 3 replies.
But good on you for putting that on the bottom.
Well, why not? I mean, I can't do math. And that's not what I'm here for. That's not what I'm here for. Apparently,
I was specifically told there was no math on this show.
The Bob Costas, in 51 and a half minutes at the top of the 7 o'clock hour, we'll have a lot of fun with him, and obviously, great detailed insight on all matters of today, and bit of a blast from the past with Bob.
Oh,
and
yeah.
We'll use that as a bit of a hook and explain a little later. The Raptors get it done, 116-93 over the Mavs. I mean, that, or 113-96. That was an absolute ass kicking. And this team has now won 3 in a row and are looking suddenly quite good, working their way back toward the playoffs. We'll discuss that in a few minutes. Sheldon Keefe, after his Leafs won effectively a 1-goal game, but a 3-1 game over the Winnipeg Jets last night.
Leave the game feeling good about the effort the guys put in today. At the same time, I'm fairly confident that we're going to have a number of things to discuss tomorrow and where we can continue to get better. And you know, that's obviously very positive. We're still not where we can be. And, you know, it's going to take us a little more time. Keep getting a little bit better every day.
I thought last night was hugely, hugely encouraging on a number of fronts. This team was clearly the better team in the first period. I don't think that there are enough words to clearly express how dominant the Maple Leafs were, even though they weren't particularly rewarded. They scored their first couple of goals in the second period, but gave one up really late. So you're up 2-1, and it doesn't reflect how tilted the ice was in the second period. But that is how good the Maple Leafs can be. However, you're sitting there as a Leafs fan watching second intermission coverage on Sportsnet Ontario.
Plug.
And you're saying to yourself, uh-oh, we have been by far the superior team over the first 40 minutes of this game, but we're in the locker room and we got a one-goal lead. And Frederik Andersen has been a little turbulent here early on in the season. The Maple Leafs have a reputation for being in the defensive zone, occasionally prone to the river hockey. When you have a third period lead, sometimes you sit back. There was no line A for the Winnipeg Jets, but they still had their firepower out there. The Scheifeleys, the Connors, et cetera, of the world. What's this going to look like? Well, Winnipeg pushed. Freddie Andersen made the saves. And the Maple Leafs, Hazel, with a little bit of, you know, Mitch Marner gets the empty net goal, and then there's a little bit of a back and forth with Scheifele and Neil Pionk. So there's some life there. They come away with a very neat and tidy, solid 3-1 win, and now they got three wins and one loss early on in a season that absolutely requires you to get off to a good start.
You talked about how dominant they were. They outshot the Jets 19-1. And what I really liked about this particular game was all their top-tier talent came through for them. You know, they were all dominant. Freddie Andersen, who we talked a lot about, I think he really quieted the noise with his performance last night.
For 24 hours.
You know, and Sheldon Keefe said it. You know, he looked confident. He looked calm. He looked in control. And a stark contrast to Friday night's performance. I think this will go a long way when it comes to Andersen's confidence moving forward. And, you know, I'm sure it reassures some Leaf fans out there. Like you said, it may be short-lived. But I think what you saw was what Leafs fans are hoping to see, but over a sustainable and longer period. And that, to me, what was really encouraging was your Marners, your Matthews, your Tavares, the guys that you expected to step up, all did at the same time. You got good goaltending. I mean, this is the type of Leafs team that Leafs fans would enjoy watching.
Well, and we were on the air yesterday morning with both Jason Spezza and Aaron Dell on waivers. And Spezza wasn't claimed, and then he was added back to the roster, and he played last night. Nobody was going to claim Jason Spezza because he was going to retire. He made that very clear. If I have to leave Toronto, well, I'm not going to leave Toronto. I'm not leaving my family in the middle of a pandemic. So there was no, I won't repeat what I said yesterday,
just in case I
offended the CRTC or the CBSC. I don't want to do that, but nobody was going to be that team to take that guy. But they lose Aaron Dell. Now, I went to sleep last night. Aaron Dell's a Leaf. Aaron Dell's a New Jersey Devil. Whatever. It's always been about and is always going to be about Frederik Andersen this year. I think Jack Campbell is a more than capable and suitable backup. I think he's somebody that you can play in games beyond just the second halves of back-to-backs. I think it can be a good tandem. But Freddie is going to drive this bus. They will succeed in the regular season as far as he takes them, and they will succeed in the playoffs for as far as he carries them. And we've talked about, oh, just go get me a save sometimes. He got us saves last night. He got us saves in the third period. Winnipeg was crappy for the first 40 minutes of the game, and I think that had more to do with how good the Leafs were than how bad Winnipeg was or is. But they pushed in the third period, and he made 12 saves, and he looked solid doing it.
And you didn't see him give up a lot of second chances in and around
rebounds.
The net. Yeah. You know, for Andersen, and correct me if I'm wrong, is he not typically a slow starter, a guy that just, you know, needs to really get more comfortable?
By my count, with using the brain cells I have left, I remember thinking the third of his now four Octobers in Toronto, this being his fifth season, was clearly the best of the four. He had established himself in years one and two with the Leafs as a slow starter. He had a bit of a slow start last year as well. So the answer to that question is yes. It was typically like mid-November.
Okay.
Before he seemed to find a groove.
So if you're a guy that needs a little bit more time to find a groove and you go into a shortened season with, you know, no exhibition games, you know, do we need to cut him some slack early on? Or because, you know, there are a lot of games in a short amount of time, it's going to be up to him to, dude, you're just going to have to kick it up a notch and a little quicker and a little faster. What we saw last night, to me, is if he can play like that, and if you can have Campbell back him up and be, quote-unquote, serviceable, this team could be the team Leafs fans have been waiting for over these last couple of years with this core group. They all have an extra season under their belts. You're seeing a lot of maturity. You're seeing, I love the fact that Sheldon Keefe said that Austin Matthews really needed to pick up his physicality and his conditioning. And you and I talked about this before we got on air. You looked at all the ice time, and sure enough, Austin did his work in the offseason. You're seeing the fruits of that labor, and you're seeing him generate a lot of scoring opportunities. A lot of the guys generated a lot of scoring opportunities. Yes, the scoreboard shows that, you know, they only scored a handful of goals, but, I mean, there were a lot of scoring opportunities. That has to be very reassuring for Leaf fans moving forward.
And Mitch Marner was up near 25 minutes.
That's surprising.
Last night, and that has been consistent. I mean, Matthews and Marner are driving the ice time for Leafs forwards right now. John Tavares was in that 16-minute range. William Nylander was in the 16 and a half minute range last night. Obviously, they're on the same line. Joe Thornton plays 14 minutes. So, you know, there's Hyman and others who are funneling in with Matthews and Marner, and they get PK time and et cetera, power play time. But they're riding these horses now.
Right.
And it's funny. It's like Leafs Nation is divided into camps. And instead of taking things game by game, we tend to focus in on some kind of preconceived totality that we have. That William Nylander is this, and everything I see about William Nylander reinforces what I already believe. Mitch Marner went from one of the most fun kids to watch in the National Hockey League, the playmaking winger, you know, the little water bug who doesn't have a lot of size to him, right? Is, you know, not going to break a pane of glass with his shot, but the guy who can drive offense and create. Well, he's suddenly become this stilted, somewhat paralyzed by his contract, overpaid player, and he's viewed through that lens. Except if you look at how Sheldon Keefe is using these guys, and this is Sheldon Keefe's, we gotta remember this, Hazel. Time is a screwed up thing right now. This is Sheldon Keefe's first season start as a Maple Leafs head coach, right? He took over for Mike Babcock 6 weeks into the season last year. We're looking at how these guys are getting used. Mitch Marner, as an offensively gifted right winger, ain't getting 24 and a half minutes a night if his coach thinks he sucks in his own end, if his coach doesn't trust him. And I think you instill confidence in these players by giving them that ice time, giving them that rope, giving them that leash, and then letting their play determine whatever adjustments you make as we go along here. If Mitch Marner can't acquit himself in those 24 and a half minutes a night, well, they'll dial it back. If he goes into a 5 or a 10 game slump where he's not contributing much offensively and there's gaps in his defensive game, well, I'm sure we'll talk about when he's down to 17 or 18 minutes. If there's a bit of a tight groin because there are so many games here out of the gate, and you got to bring down his minutes a bit, that may happen too. But they're rolling with these guys out of the gate. They're the ones who are going to drive the bus.
Right.
It's Anderson and the big four, and figure it out in your own end.
But isn't that something coaches, isn't that a given? Like, why are you coaching by contract, is like I like to call it? Are you giving the ice time to the guys that are making a whole lot of money because you feel obligated to? Or are you not giving the ice time to the guys that are contributing? To me, that's a given. But, I mean, again, I'm not an NHL coach. I don't know what the makings and the thinking and the meetings are behind closed doors. But to me, coaching by contract and not by contribution is, you know, I think that's a recipe for, you know, a not so successful night.
Right.
Because sometimes guys have it, sometimes they don't. So why don't you play the guys, like you said, that are contributing right now? And, you know, hopefully a lot of these guys can play up to their contracts. But coaching by contract, this guy's making a lot of money. He deserves X amount of ice time. I'm not sure that is a recipe for success.
Right. And you'll hear coaches sometimes say, well, so-and-so was going tonight. This line was going tonight. If Alex Kerfoot's line is going tonight at some point, they'll play more than they do.
And they should.
In most other games.
It's a results-oriented, you know, business. So if you're contributing, you play. If you're, you know, doing your job on the ice, you get the most ice time. That's just my opinion. Because if you're not contributing, if you're not slumping, why are you on? If you're slumping, then why are you on the ice? You're not helping. The ultimate goal is to win. And if you're not on the ice and you just don't have it that night, you're not playing.
Right. And the flip side of that coin is that if you are in a close game, the guys like Austin Matthews and John Tavares can flip the script very quickly. Like if Freddie's put up 35, 40 saves in a game and you're down 3-2, you deserve to be down 7-2, but you're down 3-2 and it hasn't been Austin's night, you throw him out there with 3 minutes left. There are very identifiable players in this game who can do something good, right? Can create a something night out of what appeared to be a nothing night. But I take your point, generally speaking. The kids will drive the bus for this team. I don't think that there's any question about that. And this is now, despite the concerns that we saw on Friday night in Ottawa, 3-1. This is a good start. You got the Oil coming in tomorrow. And then you're flying west for a little bit. So take care of home ice and then get down to business as you hit the road here. Positive, positive stuff. And with no game tonight, I'm sure Freddie Anderson will be in goal for the Leafs. We're getting some people who deserve the these in front of their names.
Okay.
Chris from Kitchener. Hazel May deserves the Hazel May. She's a gem.
A gem.
Yeah. The Mike Zygomanis.
The Mike Zygomanis.
From Leaf fan Steve. The Ziggy.
We could make that happen.
Oh, wow.
I love your reactions.
I had no idea where that was coming from. Did you see me look over at Vic?
Oh, yeah.
No, who is that?
Because I'm always sitting here going, these are things I've heard a million times, but... But you haven't yet, right?
So I was like, not. Well,
let's surprise Hazel with random noises on the show.
You there?
Yeah. We could just. And we're Allison in Toronto. The Jared Porter.
Oh, we're going to go there, right?
Yes. Jared Porter is the general manager of the New York Mets. A story came out last night on ESPN. Jeff Passan, one of the reporters, it's 4 years old, and it alleges that Jared Porter, who was then working in the Chicago Cubs front office, subsequently moved on to the Arizona Diamondbacks and was just hired by the new owner of the New York Mets, Steve Cohen, to be the team's general manager. So that's quite a promotion for him. It alleges that when he worked for the Cubs, a female reporter from overseas, from Asia, we believe, was subjected to text after text after text after text after text from Jared Porter after the two had exchanged numbers for what the reporter trusted and believed were business reasons in an elevator. Jared Porter is now under the gun. If this reveals what we suspect it will, because there's a lot of verified information in the story, what should become of Jared Porter? We'll discuss that. Hugh will jump in. And Bob Costas, the great Bob Costas. I also I threw a great in there, too.
He's a bit of everything, though.
The Bob Costas is with us at 7 o'clock. This music will be on underneath when you virtually meet Joe Thornton. That's right. We are giving you, our good listener, the chance to virtually meet Joe Thornton and to enter the contest. You need to be listening every weekday for keywords, and then when you hear the keywords, text them to 590-590 to enter. We will be giving a keyword out at 8:20 this morning. The first keyword for the meet and greet with Joe Thornton.
I'm glad you said that. I was just going to ask you, what was yesterday's keyword? Where was I? But we're actually going to do it today.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Stay with the program, Hazel. Come on.
Imagine you win. That's not possible.
No.
Legalities. But imagine, how pissed off would listeners be?
If I won?
Yeah. A person who could get a sit-down with Joe Thornton is actually having a sit-down coffee with Joe Thornton.
And you and I talked about this.
You wouldn't be the Hazel May anymore.
No, that is correct. But you and I have never had the pleasure of actually having a conversation with Joe. So whoever wins, I think this is just an awesome prize.
What would you ask him? Like, how many questions about his beard would you ask him?
Like, how many things live in the beard?
And what's the weirdest thing that's got caught in that?
And how long did it take you to find it?
Yeah, exactly.
I'm constantly, Hugh, you've seen, my husband has grown a beard during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And it's like a, bib. It's like a food catcher. It's gross.
Does he look like a mountain
man? Hold on a second. I saw Barker on Thanksgiving Monday.
Yes.
Because I filled in for Blair. This is like 3.5 months ago, but I filled in for Blair on Baseball Central that day. He didn't have a crazy beard going at that point.
I should correct myself. During the first roll of the pandemic.
Wave.
Yes,
okay.
Yes. So, and he's like, what do you think? What am I supposed to think?
Well, you're
supposed to be honest with him, aren't you? it looks great. It's going to look even better when it's done.
The first wave of the pandemic, I did it too. I'll show you a photo in a commercial break. We'll judge whether I should post one on Twitter.
Okay.
I'll let you be the judge.
Okay, I will.
It was not a particularly good look. I've gone back and scrolled through my photos and gone, you were obviously thinking something at that point, but it doesn't make any sense now.
Hugh, have you ever grown like a honest to goodness big beard?
They get to a point though where they just get annoying. Like I can't grow hair on my head, but I can grow hair on my face. Then it gets like really curly and bizarre after a little while. So, yeah, I'm good for like a couple of months. Then I have to shave it off.
I don't really know how to respond to that. When Hugh grows hair, it gets curly and bizarre. Okay.
Believe me, I'm feeling
a little uncomfortable in my workplace.
This is the lead off After Dark special.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. That's right. Wasn't there something for Manscaped on the Senator's Ice? Up in Ottawa on
that's
Friday
true,
and Saturday?
There was, I mean, it was yeah. so like,
that is amazing.
Yeah, I'm just trying to dump potential endorsements in Hugh's lap.
Sure. Bring them on.
case it's getting curly and weird in Hugh's lap. There we go. Yeah. Endorsements. All right. Well, Leafs over the Jets last night, 3-1. Dominant 40 minutes. Freddie Anderson took the ball and ran with it in the third period. And the Maple Leafs are 3-1 out of the gate. The Raptors with a 20-plus point victory over the Dallas Mavericks down in Tampa last night. So suddenly they've won three in a row. Another double-double for Chris Boucher. Things are on the up and up there, and they are climbing their way back into the top eight, it would appear, in the Eastern Conference. But there is now a back-to-back set tomorrow and Friday in Tampa, both, against the Miami Heat. So that'll be a really good early season litmus test for the Raps. The breaking news story from last night, and I will cop to this, I woke up to it. The first tweet I saw was from Jeff Passan of ESPN. And he and ESPN have produced a story about brand new New York Mets general manager Jared Porter, who they hired away from the Arizona Diamondbacks, which an alleges needs to be said here, but there is a lot of evidence produced in the story, including screen caps of texts that were sent, that back in 2016, Jared Porter, when working in the Chicago Cubs front office, apparently met a female reporter from overseas, and they started talking about baseball in their elevator conversation. This female reporter thought that when Jared Porter said, "Hey, let's exchange numbers, we can talk baseball," you know, she thought she had just cultivated a source. Mm-hmm. Very normal thing. That's what you do in this industry. They exchanged numbers, and later that day, texts began back and forth. It didn't take long, as the story reports, for Jared Porter to turn some friendly banter into more forward phraseology, some photos of
body parts?
Initially covered body parts.
Mm.
Half excited body parts. Like,
you're doing so well, yeah, describing this. Go ahead.
And I don't really know it wasn't a comfortable experience for this female reporter. She stopped responding to him once she realized what was going on. And he subsequently sent dozens and dozens and dozens of texts that received no response. She brought her concerns to a member of the Chicago Cubs front office who shares her nationality. And that didn't go over so well. He didn't rat her out to Jared Porter or anything, but he didn't really give her particularly good advice. She alleges he encouraged her to try to take advantage of the situation, whatever that means, that the two should meet and talk and iron this out. She talks a lot about her culture, the country from where she's from, that the women always get blamed. Regardless of who initiates, regardless of how it all plays out, women always get blamed when a sexual scandal goes public, and therefore she was scared to come forward. She has not released her name, but she has since left journalism and now works in finance back in her native country. Jared Porter has not been the general manager of the New York Mets for a game that they have played yet, and here we are. It
is so true that the women get the blame. And it's the women that have to leave the situation for things to get better. And as someone who unfortunately has come across a situation like this, and Hugh, I was telling Scott during the commercial break that a few years ago at the winter meetings, I was, a source of mine told me that there could be a potential trade that, you know, could affect the Toronto Blue Jays. So yeah. I went to the high-ranking executive of the organization that was said to be in talks with the Blue Jays and, you know, asked him about it. And he said, well, you know, I'll check in with my general manager, and I'll get back to you. So, you know, give me your phone number, and, you know, if something happens, I will definitely reach out to you.
Yep.
And I thought this was great. You know, this is great. We exchanged numbers. Okay, I had another source that I could count on. If news broke, I was, you know, I told my producer at the time, you know, if anything happens, I've got a contact. We're good to go. And then later that night, Hugh.
Oh, jeez.
Ding. Yeah. I get a text. And the text, I'm paraphrasing it, is, I'm sure you've had, you know, a long day of work. I have a bottle of wine. I'm in suite, blah, 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 blah. If you want to, you know, put your feet up and talk.
Yeah. Talk.
Nowhere in the text was there a mention of a possible trade.
No.
So, you know, I looked at this and I turned to my producer and I said, now what am I supposed to do with this? Because if I come back with, I can't believe you took our conversation to mean this situation and not a baseball situation, and I would have loved to say some more stronger words.
Yeah, I'll bet.
Now what happens, Hugh, if the trade comes and now I've got to deal with this guy? So that's the dilemma a lot of women in this business have, is I still, you know, need these guys as contacts and sources. So I have to deal with it very carefully. It's like walking a tightrope. You don't want to offend anyone.
No.
Just in case they look at you and go, that's not the intention.
Yeah, you left it just vague enough.
Right.
And I wonder why men in sports or in positions of power, but we're talking about sports in particular here, why they do it and feel that there won't be repercussions. Is it because that they feel insulated, or is it because they're just ignorant of the fact, and because they've maybe been insulated their entire life, their entire career, they're men of power, they're used to getting their way, no one ever says no to them. Is that the reason why they don't look past the text? Like they don't look, you know, a month or 6 months into the future.
Right, Hugh, I have been really lucky to work with male counterparts, male colleagues like yourself and Scott MacArthur, that aren't jerks. And I'm just going to say it. You are a jerk if you think because of your power or your stature or status in this industry, you feel like you can sexually harass women. You're a jerk. And in many cases, you should be charged.
Yeah.
To me, it's so sad. Listen, and I'm saying this for me. If a woman is not interested, men, we are not interested. The fact that you send photos is not going to all of a sudden, oh my gosh.
Oh my God, I had
no idea.
Look at the kibbles and bits on that guy.
Behind those Wrangler jeans, I had no idea. Now, all of a sudden, I'm going to do a 180 and think, I'll go and have a drink with me. We are not interested.
Yeah, and
we
are not
interested.
I think maybe that's where the ignorance part comes in. It's like, she couldn't possibly want to reject me. I'm this powerful baseball executive. No one ever says no to me.
Exactly.
And it should be noted that according to the report, all of this stemmed from one face-to-face meeting.
Yeah, the elevator meeting.
Yeah, exactly. So how long could that be? Like 30, 40 seconds?
Right.
Maybe?
Yeah, and exchange numbers, and she's cultivating a source and getting on with her life. It's just so
It's
weird.
Sad because actually from that point on, Scott and Hugh, like I'm very, now I feel hesitant to ask for numbers.
And that's the thing, Hazel.
You've handcuffed me in doing my job because now I don't want you to think I'm asking you for your number because I want a bottle of wine with you in your suite.
Yeah, I mean, there's a difference between, hey, can I have your number, and hey, can I have your number? Right?
Hey there, hubba hubba.
I think the thing that you hit on right there, Hazel, is you did a great job before of laying out the back and the forth and the machinations of doing the job. But it's also how you walk around feeling.
Like, as if I had said something.
Uncertain.
Absolutely.
Weird. Yes. Who has this guy maybe
awkward.
Told?
Yes.
Then you get into your own head about all of that stuff, and it just, it can be this long and winding and uncomfortable road that spirals you out and actually prevents you from doing the very best, if as if this is the not the priority, but it also prevents you from being able to do
correct.
The very best job that you can do.
Correct. And I, you know, I'm going to, my producer, Jacob Clark, who was with me, was, you know, he was horrified, and he actually helped me formulate a response, because this is early in the winter meetings and this possible trade could happen. And I did not want to, even though the text he sent me was totally, totally off base. I needed to keep this contact because it was a crucial part of me doing a good job for the network. And it really is sad. And Hugh, I don't know, is there a male version of that kind of situation that female reporters go through?
Like,
I don't know.
Like do like when I was in the field, did I have female executives texting me?
I guess so. Is there
probably
is,
not, because there aren't a lot of female
never,
executives.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Never.
Yeah, good point.
Never. Now, without going into any kind of detail, is this person you're speaking of, are they still a contact for you?
No. Okay. I have not reached out to this person. I have seen this person is still in the game, and I politely say hello.
Yeah.
And
they keep
how
it
are
civil.
You?
Yeah.
Absolutely. And what you were saying, Scott, is so true, because after that text exchange, I remember saying to my producer, I'm going through my conversation in my head. Was there anything I said? And you know, Jacob is like, no, this is totally not on you. And I'm thinking to myself, what did I say? How did I say it? Did I say something that made him think that this could be something I was interested in? And no, you're just a jerk.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. The male brain goes from 0 to 100 real quick sometimes. I look, and I'm not making light of this situation when I say this, but there's always a Seinfeld scene for this. And you remember one of the early episodes where Jerry's girlfriend was driving him nuts, but he loved the sex. And there was the brain Jerry and the penis Jerry playing chess at his table. And I'm not making light of the situation, but dude clearly lost his mind.
Yeah.
Lost
yeah,
his
getting
mind.
Back to Jerry.
And that
yeah.
does not excuse the behavior.
No.
Does not excuse the behavior. Reel it in, pal.
Yeah. He says that in the last, I guess, text blast, there were 17 texts and 15 of them were just hotels, restaurants, that kind of thing. And the one really explicit one he said was a joke stock photo.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't believe that it wasn't even mine makes it
no.
better.
No.
No.
No. Exactly.
Didn't Brett Favre try
oh, yeah.
that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, we've who among us doesn't keep photos of other people's penises on their phones to send his jokes to random people who we may come across at winter meetings yeah. and in elevator chats? It's who among us? Like, what?
Let he who's without sin, right?
Yeah. yeah,
come on.
Let he who has not kept joke stock penis photos on his phone.
Joke stock.
Cast the first stone.
That'd also be a great name for a band.
Jared Porter. What? Cast the first stone?
No.
Or joke stock penis
there,
photos?
There you go.
Sounds like a heavy metal band
yeah,
from...
Yeah.
All right.
So what are the Mets, and real quick, what are the Mets going to do?
I don't know.
I don't know.
Like they had Beltran, they had to fire him over the whole Houston Astros
yeah, cheating
thing
scandal,
a year ago.
Yeah.
He never managed a game for them. And now they got Jared Porter and Brody Van Wagenen, who they fired to hire Porter
right.
when the new owner took over. He was only the GM there for a couple of years. So they brought on all these guys. They're supposed to contend. They made the Lindor trade. Now you look at it and go, can they possibly move forward with this guy?
Here's my fear.
So.
If you did it back in 2016, shows me that you're not afraid to do it, and you've likely done it again.
Yeah, very rare one-time
offenders of joke stock photos.
Yeah, joke stock photos.
It was an
photos.
Accident.
Yeah, I think joke stock photos are going to become something you say on this show. 416-870-0590, 416-870-0590. We got $100 in Untuckit gift cards that we give away at this time each and every morning. We do it by playing All or Nothing. You be our contestant and do it by calling now.
It's time to play All or Nothing with Ziggy and Scotty Mack on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Right, $100 in Nantucket gift cards up for grabs. All or Nothing, three true or false questions, which you need to get all right or all wrong to win. So how you answer question one determines what you need to do with questions two and three. Let's go up to Maple for Frank. Hello, Frank.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good luck to you. Hazel's got
Thank
question
you.
One.
Morning, Frank. How
Morning,
are
Hazel.
You today?
Good. Yourself, Hazel?
We are great. Okay, here's your question. Okay, more Chiefs talk. Patrick Mahomes has only one loss in his playoff career. Frank, that's so easy. True or false?
True.
That is correct. He's 5-1. The only loss against, well, Tom Brady and the Patriots in the AFC Championship game a couple years ago.
It's always like personal losses and Tom Brady in the same sentence for almost every other NFL player.
Good job, Frank.
Frank, you're in good shape. Get the next two correct, and the gift cards are yours. Hugh, question two.
Okay, Frank, here we go. Chris Boucher, red hot, 21 points last night for the Raptors. In fact, he's playing so well that he was inserted into the starting lineup last night against Dallas. Is that true or is that false?
True.
Nah, that's false. Lowry, Van Vliet, Ananobi, Siakam, and Baines was your starting five for the Raptors last night.
Damn.
He sure played like it, though.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it won't be long, I'm sure.
Another double-double. Well, and as I say about basketball, you can be a starter most nights, but if you don't actually start when the ball's tipped, if you're not on the floor, you're considered as coming off the bench for the rest of the night.
Yeah, you
like
play like 47
severe,
minutes. Yeah.
Severe technicality. Leafs over the Jets, 3-1. Big night for Mitch Marner, another goal for John Tavares. Freddie Anderson locked it down in the third period when Winnipeg started to push. We'll revisit that. The Raps smoked the Mavs. Up next, we've been talking about it. Now it's time. The Bob Costas joins Hazel and me next. Want to begin? We got the Baseball Hall of Fame ballot. We've got the AFC and NFC Championship game set. We got Tom Brady. We got a bunch of topics to get to. So let's start with the football with our next guest. He is the great Bob Costas.
The legendary.
The legendary. It is an honor to have Bob Costas on the program this morning. Bob, good morning. How are you?
God, I'm fine. Hello, Hazel. Could you start over? Because I don't think that introduction is quite flowery or appreciative enough.
For the hour that you have awakened to do this interview.
What you didn't see, Bob, was we were genuflecting at the same time.
Oh, well, then that makes a difference. Yeah. Okay.
And here's,
now you're fine.
And here's Hazel using words that none of the rest of us understand already in this conversation. Bob, it's wonderful to have you on, and we thought we'd start with Tom Brady. And I was saying on the program yesterday that not to discount the work that has so clearly gone into Tom Brady's career achieving what he has, but is there a guy, is there an athlete who has in his own way carved out a more charmed life? He's going to the 14th championship game of his career, first in the NFC. Mm-hmm. He's got an opportunity to deny Aaron Rodgers the desired second ring, at least for another year. And the cherry on top of the whipped cream on top of the sundae would be that he would become the first quarterback of a team to host a Super Bowl in their city should Tampa Bay beat Green Bay on Sunday. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really quite something. Is there anyone who comes close in your mind to Tom Brady and his achievements?
Well, there's always Michael Jordan. Mm-hmm. And there are other people you can cite because of how prodigious their achievements were. But if you're talking about everything else, what we know, and I tend not to spend much time dwelling on other people's private lives, but what we know about his life overall and the way he's played it. And much like Derek Jeter, he's managed to be a gigantic star and avoid controversy. Jeter is a great, great player and obviously a first ballot Hall of Famer, got all but one vote. But Jeter is not as great a baseball player objectively as Tom Brady has been a football player. You put it all together and maybe there are some kind of at the same level, but it's hard to put anybody ahead of him. I remember just when you were saying Tampa Bay versus Green Bay for a trip to the Super Bowl, back when I was hosting the NFL on NBC, both those teams were often lousy at the same time. And when they'd play, the headline was Bay of Pigs. See, that's a political reference,
yes,
Scott, to something that happened in the early 60s.
I remember Cuba. Yeah, I got that. I got that. I've read some books.
JFK and Cuba and Castro and that whole thing. This is where I sometimes get in trouble with a portion of the audience. I'm too esoteric for their taste. And I have to apologize for having a frame of reference that goes beyond cover two.
Well, between genuflecting and esoteric, at some point I'm going to have to make the quota. Is that the it would be quite something if he sends Drew Brees into retirement, denies Aaron Rodgers a third Super Bowl appearance, second ring, et cetera, to cross into the NFC, to have some early season hiccups, and yet to end up in the NFC championship game at 43, now going on 44 years old.
It's quite a story. It's classic. You know, back a few years ago, when Seattle wound up playing the Patriots in the Super Bowl, and the Patriots got that interception at the goal line to save the game, the NFC, or yeah, that's right, NFC championship game prior to that was Green Bay at Seattle, which the Packers did everything but win. And Rodgers was secretly fuming. He didn't publicly call out Mike McCarthy's decision-making, but they settled for field goals when they maybe should have pressed on, when they had their foot on the Seahawks' necks early in the game. Somehow, that game got away. Now, the Seahawks were the defending champions trying to win the second straight Super Bowl, and it was Russell Wilson against Tom Brady, but that was a chance for Aaron Rodgers against Tom Brady, and Rodgers was at his peak then, and he sustained that peak for a very long time. You know, if it weren't Brady that you were talking about, you'd be talking about how incredible Rodgers has been and how long he has sustained his excellence. The only thing that's missing here when you talk about a game in Green Bay where the weather could be a factor, particularly for a team that is housed in Florida, there's no fans. And if the Bucs win the game and host the Super Bowl, in effect, there will be only a smattering of fans. Maybe they can put 15,000 people in the stadium. So it won't have quite the same feel that it would under non-COVID circumstances, but it will still matter if they can play at home.
Brady and Belichick, Bob, have been tied together for so long, have experienced a great deal of success, and there was much talk. Could Belichick succeed without Brady? Could Brady succeed without Belichick? It's one season. Can we make a conclusion about whether Tom Brady is good enough on its own?
Well, first of all, he would have been great with almost anybody, but that was a perfect pairing, and it was mutually beneficial. In Belichick's defense, his feeling is, as you know, he basically runs the personnel department as well as coaching the team. His feeling was that they were boxed in terms of what they could do, and he's kind of reloading maybe for one last run. Part of the reason why Tom left is that he felt he had insufficient weapons at receiver, and he handpicks his situation, much like LeBron James. Handpicks a situation. Gronkowski comes out of retirement. Somehow they figure out a way to keep Antonio Brown kind of calmed down and have him be a useful player. Bruce Arians has always been an offense-oriented coach. That's a perfect marriage. So it worked out. I don't know that it indicts Belichick. I don't know that we can walk away and say on that small sample size, Brady was more than 50% of it, and Belichick was less important.
Bob Costas is our guest on Leadoff, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Bob, you've been outspoken through the years, including during your time with the NFL on NBC about headshots in the sport. And it was striking this past weekend that two of the young quarterbacks left in the playoffs, Lamar Jackson and Patrick Mahomes, both had to leave their games early for concussion protocol. And you also had a non-call on Kansas City's Daniel Sorensen for his hit that dislodged the football from Rashard Higgins of Cleveland on the goal line, the touchback rule, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Lots of headshots, a couple of concussions verified this weekend. What is the balance between taking care of players and making sure the rules are enforced and understanding that football in and of itself is a somewhat, at the very least, violent sport?
The last thing you said, Scott, is the whole thing, except I take out the word somewhat.
Yeah.
The very nature of the game is that there is going to be head trauma. You can mitigate it, but you cannot eliminate it. They are beginning to coach, not just at the NFL level, but at other levels of the sport. I don't think the message has sunk in completely, but they are beginning to coach away from headshots. Don't target anything above the shoulders, etc. But the game is so fast that even when it's unintentional, you're going to have some of these situations where in a microsecond, the target changes because of the athleticism and speed of the players, and you're going to have this. It's just part of the nature of the game. What has turned me off going back many, many years is the celebration of violence. You never see someone make a textbook tackle and then jump up and celebrate themselves. The exhibitionism that's too pervasive in sports annoys me anyway. There's a difference between true style and just being an obnoxious exhibitionist and celebrating yourself and going through an elaborate pre-practice dance when your team has scored a touchdown that puts them behind 33-14. You know, that is a little annoying, but what's more annoying is the celebration of the most vicious hits. That part of it just kind of brings to the surface, although people are so addicted to football they don't want to acknowledge it, it brings to the surface the fact that this is an inherently violent game, and for some, I don't think this is an overstatement, it's a barbaric game.
Do you think, and I my sense is you're specifically talking about players after big hits, but do you think broadcast networks have done enough in the sense that ESPN stopped doing the jacked up segment many, many years ago as an example? Is there more to do, or have we mitigated our encouragement of this type of behavior enough?
I think there's an awareness about it, and there are fairly strict protocols. Might have been, I don't know, wasn't there and haven't checked on anything yet this morning. I don't know the extent of Patrick Mahomes' injury, for example, but in the past, a player might have been able to argue their way back into the game, and a coach or offensive coordinator might have encouraged that. So I do think that there's been a change in that respect, but let's face facts. People are so addicted to football, whether it's college or pro. Every hypocrisy, every kind of look the other way thing, because that's unpleasant, but we don't want to acknowledge it. It's, you know, it's like, hey, we're doing what we can. Let's move on. What's the line on the game? Get me DraftKings phone number, blah, blah, blah. You know, fine. And by the way, that's you're talking to me about this, and I have an overview. But I said to Rich Eisen a couple of months ago, he brought something up about the NFL. And I said to him, and seriously, at this point in my life, if you ask me to name the head coach and the starting quarterback of all 32 NFL teams at any given time and my life dependent on it, I'd begin to check on my last will and testament.
Well, you've just given Hazel and I an idea. Well, we're going to test each other's knowledge of that in the next segment. Bob Costas, our guest on Leadoff, Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Yeah, Hall of Famer Bob Costas, who's a 4C Frick Award winner. Bob, you know on Tuesday the MLB Hall of Fame Class of 2021 is going to be announced. I guess the big question is whether anyone is going to get in. Curt Schilling, Roger Clemens, Barry Bonds, they're all in their ninth year on the ballot. Each of them got over, I believe, 60% of the vote last year. Not sure if they'll hit that 75% mark. Schilling, of course, the closest at 70. Yeah. Where does Bob Costas draw the line? Is it PEDs, the steroids, the character issue? Where do you draw the line? And do you think this group deserves to be in the Hall?
Before answering that specifically, Hazel, this is just a thought, and I'm not sure it's going to play out, but I think it's a possibility. The electorate keeps changing, by the way. It's becoming younger. Some of the older voters have been phased out, not purposely, but they've retired or whatever it might be, and now you have more people that have qualified by having covered baseball for 10 years. And generally speaking, the younger portion of the electorate is more forgiving about PED use than some of the old timers were. Pardon me. But I think you can't read the voters' minds. But I think that there's a possibility that voters will say, look, all three of these guys have one more year on the ballot after this. Assuming they're able to have a ceremony this summer in Cooperstown, that ceremony is headed by Derek Jeter, virtually universally popular. Mm-hmm. Why let controversial figures kind of spoil or compromise that moment? Not just for Derek Jeter, but also for Ted Simmons and Larry Walker. So I think some voters may have been inclined all along to vote for Clemens and Bonds and maybe Schilling at the last moment and sort of let them twist in the wind until then. And now when you add this circumstance to it, where in theory, this year's inductees would be married to last year's inductees, and that includes marrying Derek Jeter's ceremony to that of Schilling, Bonds, Clemens, all three of them, two of them, whatever it might be, I think that some of the voters will say, look, there's still a year to go. I'll lay off. Now, to answer your question, I always felt that Curt Schilling, on his merits, deserved to be in the Hall of Fame. Mm. I've said it from the very start. I would have voted for him on the first ballot. As you know, Hazel, we don't have a vote as broadcasters. We have an opinion, but it's only baseball writers who have a vote. I would have voted for Schilling. It isn't just the raw statistics, and he does have the best strikeout-to-walk ratio of any starting pitcher in the modern history of the game since 1900. But it is a Hall of Fame. And so big moments that are part of the game's lore count, and his postseason record, the bloody sock plus the mere statistics of his postseason record, more than qualify him. Now, I don't think that anyone's political beliefs, conservative, liberal, or anywhere in between, should be a factor. But in the minds of many, and it isn't unreasonable to think it, if you look at some of the things Curt has said and tweeted, many reasonable people put that as outside the bounds of normal political speech, that there's an element that they take serious objection to. And if Curt Schilling does not get in the Hall of Fame either next year or this year or next, that's going to be the reason, because he's at 70% right now and his achievements qualify him. Now, when it comes to Bonds and Clemens, I have a tortured rationale. And that rationale is that I'm not entirely comfortable with it. If someone was not just Hall of Fame worthy, but an inner circle elite Hall of Famer, no question about it, on the first ballot before, as best we can determine, they ever touched anything more potent than a protein shake, I am willing to vote them or see them voted into the Hall of Fame. Barry Bonds, on his natural merits, is among the greatest all-round players in baseball history. Clemens, through the late 90s, not quite at the level of Bonds, but certainly a no question about it Hall of Famer. You have some others whose achievements either are not as transcendent, or you can't be 100% sure that they would have been at that level without PEDs. So my tortured rationale is Clemens and Bonds, yes. Rafael Palmeiro, for example, no.
I was fascinated by an interview by your colleague on High Heat, Chris Russo. He was talking to Jeff Kent, and Jeff Kent said he thought it was very unfair to compare players that played in different generations. What's your take on that, Bob?
Well, we now have advanced metrics that compare players to the norm of their generation, the era in which they played, OPS plus, ERA plus, et cetera, et cetera. So we have a way of accounting for that, allowing for ballpark effects, et cetera. But, of course, Jeff is right in a general sense. Al Kaline, I'm just picking that name at random, passed away this past year. There was no doubt among people who were aware of baseball in the 50s and 60s that Al Kaline, after Ted Williams had retired, Al Kaline was the second best player in the American League on an all-around basis year in, year out to Mickey Mantle. Bobby Abreu's lifetime stats, in the minds of some, would put him ahead of Al Kaline. Al Kaline's a certain look, your eyeball test, you know it when you see it, Hall of Famer. Bobby Abreu, not so much. So to me, it matters where does the player rank, not just in the public imagination, but statistically against his peers. So Jeff Kent is right in that respect. He has the most home runs of anybody whose primary position was second base. He was a big-time offensive player in a big-time offensive era, whether he was a PED guy himself or not, for a variety of reasons, PED just being the leading one. Offense exploded during the prime of Jeff Kent's career, but he does have those offensive numbers. He was a less-than-average defensive player, and some people hold that against him.
Bob Costas, our guest on Leadoff, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Bob, whether it's been the experimentation with pitch clocks, the elimination of the four-pitch intentional walk, limiting mound visits, we know baseball has been concerned about pace of play, length of games. We've now seen the next step taken, which is the hiring of one of the truly brilliant minds in the game, Theo Epstein, into the commissioner's office to consult on these matters. Where, I mean, I can't ask you to predict what Theo's going to come up with, for goodness sake. That's, you just got hired. This is what he's charged with doing over the next little while. But do you have a guess on where some of the areas Theo may take this? What some of the areas may be that he goes?
You know what I thought, Scott, was very interesting? When Theo flatly said, some of what I was at the forefront of implementing is good for gaining a winning edge, and it's bad for baseball as an entertainment product. I've been saying that very thing for a decade or more. The analytics are indispensable, but baseball is a business and it's an entertainment product. It's supposed to have, it's part of its essential appeal, it's supposed to have a pleasing, leisurely pace. It's not supposed to have a lethargic pace. That would be true if somehow games were taking 3.5 to 4 hours in 1958. That would have been a problem. But now, especially in a short attention span society with people consuming everything in snippets rather than at length, people think reading a paragraph now is the equivalent of reading a novel. Their attention span has been so reduced. That's an even more particular problem for baseball now. Some things are just window dressing. What? Point to first base on an intentional walk? There's one intentional walk on average per game, both teams combined. That's really going to help the problem. I do, however, advocate a pitch clock with nobody on base. You can't do it with someone on base, but a pitch clock with nobody on base. I think eliminating shifts would not be a bad idea because the shift cuts down on ball and play excitement. The ball's in play, obviously, if it's hit into the shift. But what would be a base hit, and a guy's trying to go from first to third or score from second or whatever it might be, that's eliminated or greatly reduced. Other sports have rules about where you can be on the field of play. So I think they could consider that you have to have two players on either side of second base. Now, that could mean that the second baseman's instep is on the first base side of the bag, and the shortstop's instep is on the third base side of the bag. But you have to have two at least on either side of the bag. That might not be that might be a pretty good idea. And you might want to have umpires cracking down on how often a batter can step out of the box. You've got guys now going back to Hazel's old town where she worked in Boston. Think of J.D. Martinez. J.D. Martinez steps out of the batter's box after every pitch. He takes a ball outside. He hasn't swung the bat. Nothing has happened. He steps out after every pitch. And part of what he's doing, and because he's so successful and a mentor to younger players, is that he's running through his mind all of the analytics. Now the count is 1-0. instead of the first pitch of the at-bat. What do I know about what this guy is likely to do to me? What did he do the last time when the count was 1-0? All this stuff running through his head. The analytics have slowed the game down in more ways than we may realize. And if Theo is willing to say, look, hey, we got to strike a balance here, I think that's a step in the right direction. I think it's a progressive step by Rob Manfred.
Bob, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for your time this morning. We appreciate you doing this. And I mean, if you'd love, we'd have you on weekly if possible.
We should have a 6-part miniseries, but I think Jill would kill me if we kept Bob on any longer. Bob Costas, thank you so much, sir. Keep safe. You have plenty of admirers here in Canada, and thank you for the time, Bob.
You know, can I say one last thing?
Yes, of course.
Yeah, okay. The last thing you said, plenty of admirers in Canada. So whatever the anger and angst was about the 1989 A's, Blue Jays, ALCS, has time healed those wounds?
Of course. If they're going to forgive Harold Reynolds for the pop-up miscue, they were certainly going to forgive the one and only Bob Costas. You know, you're a dear friend, and I appreciate your time.
You got it, Hazel. See ya. Bye, Scott.
The great Bob Costas.
He's the best. He really is. He is such a nice man.
And now's the moment when we cop to something. Now, Bob's out on the West Coast.
He is.
So we hung around after the show yesterday and did that interview late yesterday morning, our time.
Correct.
What he said there at the end about 1989, the Oakland Blue Jays playoff series, we continued to have a conversation off air that Silent Vic actually was recording. And Bob has given us permission to play our sort of informal chat that we had afterward.
Bob Costas after dark.
Bob Costas after hours. We're stealing it from Hockey Night in Canada. After Hours with Bob Costas at 8:30, where he'll take us back to 1989, Blue Jays and A's, and how he became, for a couple of days, the most hated person in Toronto. We'll also reset the Leafs and the Raps. Wins for both last night coming up. Is this Sportsnet 590 The Fan or Classic Hits Key 590?
I love it.
You got to remember Classic Hits Key 590.
I am.
Back in the day.
Yeah. Music of Your Life, was it CJCL?
So, well, that's, yeah, CJCL 1430, which, of course, is The Fan. It became The Fan 1430, Fan 590. But before The Fan moved to 590 in 94, 95, it was Key 590, like an oldies music station, which is... I don't know why history jumped into my head when
I listened to, what is that, Yacht Rock on Sirius XM during the summer. So.
Yacht? Like
Yacht Rock.
Y-A-C-H-T, yeah. Like I'm on my boat
chilling.
Correct.
And that's the kind of music that you would be listening to as you're, you know, on your yacht. And how many of us have our yachts?
Well, apparently you do. And
I know. It's Hazel, just the name of the station.
The hand is up for an invite in the Toronto Harbor next summer. What's the name of your yacht? Barker's Boat?
Barker's Beauty?
Barker's Beauty. Oh, the price is wrong.
Oh, my gosh. I went there.
Oh. Doug and Brantford on the text line at 590-590. Hazel, who said we've forgiven Harold Reynolds? He's still an idiot.
Oh.
Harold Reynolds seems like a decent dude.
He's more than a decent dude.
He seems like a really nice guy.
Every time I see him in the postseason, he says, are they still mad at me? He jokes. I said, no, they are not mad at you. Apparently, one guy's mad at him.
Next time, and Harold Reynolds would have no idea who I am, but just say that you've got a friend who finally got electricity in his igloo. But only after cashing in the insurance on my car after I hit a moose. That's what allowed me to afford it. And then just perpetuate the myth. It'll all go well. It's amazing what they think about us. It's
poor
like
Harold.
You've obviously seen a moose.
Yes. Beaver.
you know, you got 2 weeks in the summer where there's no snow. Your money is different colors, although we're pretty much moving to a cashless society now, so that one's going to go by the wayside. J-Hap, you know, remember the fascination with bagged milk? Like things, man, just stuff.
What about
the hoose? I keep the text coming to 590-590, and we will play Bob Costas after hours, 1 hour from now. So we just chatted with Bob for about 25 minutes, and then we had an informal conversation with him off the air, but it was still recording when we talked to him yesterday, and he tells the story of the 1989 American League Championship Series where his call of a couple of home runs, Ernie Witts for the Blue Jays and another for Oakland's, and a comment he made when the A's brought in their great closer, now Hall of Famer, Dennis Eckersley, the controversy and consternation it caused in Toronto, and that he landed in Toronto and was not the most popular figure in this town or in this country at the time. So we'll play that for you.
The detail, the stuff that he remembers from that day is incredible.
The thing about that interview that stood out to me, and as you and I were conducting it and listening to what Bob said, it's very clear to me why he is as good as he is and why he has been at the top of the game for as long as he has been and why he is so good at many different things, whether it's play-by-play in baseball, he'll probably do play-by-play of football, but anchoring the pre and post and halftime shows, the NFL on NBC for as long as he did, covering the Olympics, the Kentucky Derby, on and on we could go. He is extremely meticulous, not just in his research, but his recall for detail. Like, wait an hour, and you'll hear it an hour from now. The detail. This stuff happened more than 31 mm-hmm. years ago.
I told you this story, and I'll quickly say it because I know we've got to get going. When I had the great pleasure of working with Bob at the MLB Network, I remembered he was in studio taping intros to features, and he wrote what he was going to say on prompter. So I made my way into master control, into the control room to watch because I want to watch Bob Costas at work. Scotty, I tell you, he read that 30-second intro about a half dozen times and kept stopping and starting and doing it again because he wasn't happy with his inflection, his tone. He just said, you know, no, let's do it again. Let's do it again. I kid you not. He did that. He spent probably 15 to 20 minutes on one 30-second intro because it had to be right. And to me, that was such a, you know, this is why he's Bob Costas. He is so good because he wants to be prepared. He wants to do his job well. I don't want to say he's a perfectionist. His benchmark for his work is so high. It has to be the best that he can possibly do.
After hours with Bob Barker.
It's not.
Bob Costas. I'm getting my names mixed up now. I mean, I'm still thinking about the yacht, Barker's Beauty,
yeah.
All that stuff.
And the, you know, Price is Right.
It's
yeah.
Bob Costas. Trust me. Bob Costas, after hours, 1 hour from now, the story of the 1989 ALCS, told with his permission because it was technically an off-air conversation.
Ask, yeah.
Technically an off-air conversation. Leafs, last night, 3-1 winners over the the Winnipeg Jets. And they're 3-1. This was essentially a one-goal victory. I know that when you sprinkle in 4, 5, 6-0 wins over the course of a season, that's a night where players can take their foot off the pedal just a little bit. Coaches can ease up on the ice time for their best players, spread the four lines out just a little bit more because the game is under control if you've taken the lead early. Fans at home can put the feet up, chill a little bit, and there's not a sense of urgency quite as much. But I'm telling you, Hazel, there is value. There is value in winning a hockey game the way the Maple Leafs did last night. They were the better team in the first period. They were dominant. And the website Natural Stat Trick will show you. They were about as dominant as a team could be in the second period last night. And despite all of that, they had built for themselves late in the second period only a 2-0 lead. 40 or so seconds after they score the 2-0 goal, they give one up. last minute of a period goal. Now, all of a sudden, you've been clearly far and away the best team, but you're only up by one heading into the third period. We've got questions about our goaltender. We got questions about our defensive zone coverage, and that goes back years and years, arguably a decade and a half, 2 decades now. It's almost since Pat Burns, maybe even longer than that, that you've truly felt comfortable with the Leafs' D-zone coverage. All of those things are washed away for a period of time, at least, with the performance in the third period. Freddie's 12 saves, mm-hmm. not a lot of 5 alarm bell chances for the Jets. And while they did push the pace, the Leafs held the fort. And there was pushback. The empty netter at the end ices the victory. That is the type of victory that I think instills some confidence in the coaches, makes the players feel good, and gives the fan base a bit of a respite from this constant peak and valley wave that we seem to have to ride with this group.
You and I talked about Anderson at length yesterday, so my focus was on him, and I loved what Sheldon Keefe said after. You know, Freddie looked confident. He looked calm. He looked in control. I think, you know, what he showed yesterday should reassure Leaf fans for a little bit anyways. He looked confident in the crease. You didn't see him give up a lot of second chances in and around the net. He just looked like the Freddie Anderson that Leaf fans have seen in the past and hopefully continue to see moving forward. And you said this in our first hour, that he is typically a slow starter. And I'm wondering whether no exhibition games, how much does that affect a slow starter like a Freddie Anderson? Having no exhibition games and having to kind of, you know, accelerate your routines because you're seeing a lot more games in a shorter period of time in a shortened season. I'm curious. You know, definitely last night was his best performance of the early goings. And like you said, that kind of performance should quiet the noise for a little bit, but it also should give Leaf fans a lot more confidence in that, you know, the Freddie Anderson they saw last night is the Freddie Anderson that can take this team to the next level.
There are nights where you have a nice team victory. And Austin was up in the 23-plus minute range. Mitch was in the 24-and-a-half minute range. Johnny Tavares played 16-plus, but scored another goal. I mean, he's at darn near a two-point pace here in the early going. Some love for the captain. You know, William Nylander doing his thing. TJ Brody, I thought, was a little iffy in the first game in a bit, but has seemed to settle down. And who knows, Hazel? I mean, we can create narratives in which there may be some truths. Do the little things that occur in hockey games, whether it's Wayne Simmonds fighting Ben Chiarot, and I didn't think that fight changed the course of Wednesday night's game against Montreal, but maybe that sort of thing, Simmonds fighting again in Ottawa, maybe that brings together some cohesion. Mitch Marner with some pushback on Mark Scheifele and Neil Pionk after the empty net goal last night. Count the times on one hand last year there was a post-whistle scrum and melee involving the Leafs. Like, they are not a team that engages that way. But if they develop just a little bit of an edge, that reflects a confidence that carries a team just that step further. And I think that's what people are looking for here.
Right.
Get back at it. Don't get pushed around. Be pissed off when it's time to be pissed off.
If you don't think that fight, that Wayne Simmonds fight, you know, helped, I think what it did was really solidify his standing with his teammates. There were no fans. You know, it's really tough to get adrenaline when you've got no fans. You hope that these professional athletes are self-motivated, that the desire to win will motivate you to you know, do what you need to do to get the job done. I liked what Morgan Riley said in between periods last night. He said the goal last night was really to tighten up defensively, and I think they did that. But I also think the usual suspects, the guys you expected to contribute, did. Your top-tier talent. These guys were, you know, dominant, as you mentioned, dominant at even strength. We saw how well their power play has been over the last couple of games. Yesterday, the stars aligned. You had good goaltending. You had your top guys creating scoring chances. The guys that were expected to score, scored. It was a team win. It was a well-balanced win. And that is the Leaf effort / Leaf win that fans are hoping to see more of.
And I think for the first time in history, well, first time in more than two decades, because the Raptors did play at Skydome for a time. So they didn't share an arena with the Maple Leafs right out of the gate. But for the first time in more than 20 years, the Raps and the Leafs played a home game on the same night. The Raps down in Tampa, and it was a complete team victory for them, 116-93 over the Dallas Mavericks. Pascal Siakam with 19 points. Chris Boucher was a plus 19, another double-double, 21 and 10 boards. So they're starting to piece things together as well. And because the middle of the pack in that Eastern Conference has not charged out of the gate, the early panic, and I was a part of the panic brigade, is settling in just a little bit. But we like litmus tests for teams that are trying to rebound. How about a little two-gamer tomorrow night and Friday night, both at Amalie in Tampa against Jimmy Butler and the Miami Heat? We'll be all over that with the Raps. Coming up, something to chew on for great Canadian meat. My nickname for Tyler Chatwood, the latest Blue Jays signing. We'll call him Two Guys because so many of the at-bats against him end with four balls. Tyler Chatwood talk coming up. Something to chew on, brought to you by Great Canadian Meat. Tyler Chatwood, ex of the Colorado Rockies and more recently the Chicago Cubs, Hazel May, has been signed by the Blue Jays and is apparently going to pitch out of the bullpen. So I am not jumping on the, well, why are they selling signing Tyler Chatwood when they haven't yet secured Springer or whatever bandwagon. And Ben Nicholson-Smith is reporting that the Jays are honing in on Springer. They're really going to try to land this big fish. So we'll find out if that's successful, and it could come soon, apparently, Springer's decision. But Tyler Chatwood, I'm telling you right now, whether it's in a one-inning deal or whether he ends up doing some spots starting, because anything's possible with him, fans are going to have to understand that there are going to be bases on balls involved here. This guy signed a lucrative contract with the Chicago Cubs before the 2018 season.
Mm-hmm. Almost $40 million.
And look, it would be unfair to bring up the name Rick Ankiel, but because he wasn't throwing it to the backstop. But there were nights he had no idea where it was going. The hope, I guess, because Chatwood outside of the walks has generally good underlying numbers, the hope is that if you get him in short spurts and he's around the strike zone, he can be an effective middle reliever for you. Join the Dolises and the Romanos of the world as maybe a leverage guy later in the game.
He was described to me as a right-handed Robbie Ray, was how he was described to me. He's got a fastball that sits about 95, but there's the command issues. And to me, you know, Pete Walker is a really big part of why Robbie Ray returned to the Blue Jays. And so with the work Walker did with Robbie Ray, and we saw what he can be, I just think that if he can, you know, work with Tyler Chatwood in that same manner, I think we can get more strikes. I think you can get the command issues to decrease a little bit. So, you know, I'm going to wait and see.
Pete Walker works his ass off. Long days.
He's there before any of us show up, and he's there long after we're all gone.
And some games start at 1 o'clock on weekends. He's there bright and early in the morning, right? Because you got to put hours and hours and hours in. You got to oversee some side sessions in between starts. You go down to the bullpen and watch your guy do his thing.
I call him the pitcher whisperer.
Yeah.
If Pete Walker can't help you, I don't know who can.
Should get him on the show at some point.
Maybe tomorrow.
Maybe guilt him. Twist his arm.
Maybe tomorrow.
What are you up to anyway? Winter's in Connecticut. You're snowed in. Come and join us on the show. Tyler Chatwood, an addition to the Blue Jays bullpen. Something to chew on, brought to you by Great Canadian Meat. Bob Costas, after hours at 8:30, the story of the 1989 ALCS that he shared with us. He's given us permission, because it was an off-air conversation that we happened to be recording. He's given us permission to run it. We'll look back on that. And up next, Andrew Raycroft, Ziggy's buddy. Where does he think Ziggy is?
He probably knows.
He must know. And the play of Frederik Andersen on a night where the Leafs for 40 minutes were dominant, still okay in the third, but needed their goaltender. And Freddie was there for them. The Leafs are 3-1. Things are looking up. Can we count on the trend continuing? We'll get into it with Razor next. Andrew Raycroft of Nesson and friend of the show in just a few minutes on the Leafs' victory last night and the relative goings-on across the NHL. The breaking news, and Steve Cohen, the new owner of the New York Mets. This is timestamp 7:55 a.m., so 9 minutes ago. This is his tweet. We have terminated Jared Porter this morning. In my initial press conference, I spoke about the importance of integrity, and I meant it. There should be zero tolerance for this type of behavior. Scott MacArthur, Hazel May. And Hazel, the story, of course, is that Jared Porter met a female foreign baseball reporter in 2016 in an elevator. English is her second language. Her familiarity with Western culture, American culture at the time, was lacking because she had not spent a lot of time on this side of the ocean. And that 30 to 40 second elevator encounter resulted in an exchange of phone numbers, which she thought, as a journalist, was very simply the cultivation of a source, which is what journalists
part
need
of the job
to be able to do their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm yada, yada, yaying a lot of this, but Jared Porter took what the reporter believed to be a professional relationship and immediately made it personal, effectively blitz texting her constantly.
Harassing her.
Yeah. It started with friendly texts, which then became progressively lewd and culminated in a, as they say, look, I'm going to say it on the air, family-friendly hour. I know top of the 8 o'clock hour, they sent her a dick pic. And the New York Mets, I guess, didn't know about this, hired him anyway some 4 years later. This story broke on ESPN last night. Jeff Passan among the reporters who broke it. The reporter in question is no longer in journalism. She is back in her unnamed home country because her culture blames women for scandals of sex, even when men are to blame. She does not want her name out there. She does not want the shame to come to her or to her family. She works in finance now. She left the industry because of this experience. Jared Porter's out of a job, and he is on what I would imagine is now a growing list of people who are going to struggle, deservedly so, to find work in the industry going forward.
She no longer works in the industry. Why should he?
Right.
I mean, I applaud Stephen Cohen and the New York Mets for the swift action. They didn't come out with some lame statement that says we need time. We need time to investigate, blah, blah, blah. They apparently had the evidence. You know this type of behavior is wrong. It is wrong. There is no gray. There is no gray. The woman did not want to, you know, accept his advances. I still cannot understand why some men, not all men, and like you and I have talked about, I've been very fortunate to work with a lot of male counterparts who are respectful and professional and don't talk down to you. I'm just talking about just that group of men that think sending a photo somehow changes a woman's mind who didn't want your advances in the first place. No, no, no. That never works. It's wrong. In many cases, it is a crime to sexually harass women. In this business, unfortunately, she said that happened to her in 2016. I've had things happen to me in 2018, in 2019. There is not one female journalist that I know that has not, unfortunately, come across in some way, shape, or form some type of sexual harassment. So thank you, Stephen Cohen. Thank you, New York Mets. Things are getting better, but they're not where it should be. Kim Ng should not be the only female executive in Major League Baseball. The fact that this woman feels this shame, she called it shame, I think that's terrible. That's terrible. She did nothing wrong. Exchanging phone numbers as a source and a contact, as a way to get information to make you do your job better, is what our male counterparts can do without thinking of, you know, some type of advance to them by powerful men who feel like they can get away with it. So I applaud the swift action. There is no gray. It is wrong to treat women that way.
I think, Hazel, what happens in life is we really can only truly personalize our own experiences or the experiences of our loved ones if we are close to said experiences or if we are living through said experiences with them, trying to support them. We are directly affected by those experiences. It is too easy to depersonalize what happens to mm-hmm. others. So this incident or series of incidents that happened to this reporter, it's easy for us to sit back and depersonalize it because we weren't involved. We don't know. What's important, though, is to take that step back, chill for a second and think about it. How would I feel, not just in that moment when I receive one of those unsolicited, potentially illicit texts, but how do I feel in the minutes, the hours, the days, the weeks, the months after? Who has this person told? Oh no, now I'm getting it from somebody else. Because women deal with this stuff in this industry generally. And you're constantly having to put these fires out, fires that you did not set.
No, and she feels bad about it. And she has nothing to feel bad about. Right. That's what is so aggravating, is that you forced this woman to leave a job that, you know, I'm assuming she really wanted to be in. Otherwise, she wouldn't have been there in the first place. She's now no longer in the industry because of something she didn't do.
Right.
And something that you made her feel bad about that she didn't do. I mean, I don't understand it. It's 2020. I mean, tomorrow the United States is going to elect its first female vice president. I mean, we have come a long way, but things like this really set the notion that, you know, things are so much better back. They're not where they're supposed to be. Now, this is a small step, and taking care of this step immediately, forcefully, and swiftly was the best decision. And hopefully, if you're doing this, just stop.
Right.
Just stop it.
And she is probably an unwilling hero. But the fact, even, you know, she couldn't put her name to it. She's no longer in the industry, so she has paid an unfair, heavy price for nothing that she brought on herself.
Zero.
But she is a heroic figure in this because by speaking out about it, a couple of things. A perpetrator is out of work in an industry which affords him power, if he's in it, which could prevent future behavior by this individual in that way. And the more that we talk about it, the more it is a reminder for the people who would do these things that the buck will stop at your feet eventually. And that you need to be thinking about that. If you're not motivated by decency, you should be motivated by self-preservation at some point. Whatever the result, whatever the intent is the intent. The result needs to be that this crap needs to stop.
And thank you for saying that because, you know, we need men to speak up as well, to men to also say, hey, dude, like, bro, that's not cool. Yeah. Like that, you just don't do that. It is wrong.
Andrew Raycroft has been patiently waiting on the line. And Andrew, I know you've read up on the situation involving Jared Porter and the New York Mets, and you come at it from a former athlete's point of view. You've dealt with a variety of different reporters during the day. I mean, just a quick thought from you on what you've heard us say and what the Mets have decided to do here in firing Jared Porter.
Yeah, morning. And just listening to what you guys said the last 4 or 5 minutes, I want to echo that. You know, first off, what a donkey. Second off, great on the Mets to get rid of that donkey. And third, you know, hopefully the next donkey that thinks that it's okay, to your point, whether it's self-preservation, whether it's just human decency, it doesn't press send and put that on anyone else, you know, any female reporter. So that's my thinking. It's awful that it happens, and hopefully it is a small step that the Mets reacted the way they did, as swiftly as they did, and get this donkey out of there.
Andrew Raycroft, who is now with Nesson. And you remember Hazel from your days in Boston, right?
Easy, Razor, easy.
Yeah, absolutely, yes. Was that your first year, Hazel, in 05, 06?
No, I had the good fortune to be there 04, and I left in 08, yeah. So you were there in those Boston Bruins teams.
You were winning the Calder that year.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, I just got it's so long ago, sorry, but my ears are confused. I knew you were there those 2 years. So, yes, absolutely. It's much nicer talking to you, Hazel, and Ziggy, that's for sure.
We won't tell him that.
Oh, I will.
You know, it's interesting because of this Boston connection. The time that I was there, the Red Sox had won, the Patriots had won a couple of Super Bowls. I think the Celtics, I think I missed the Bruins Stanley Cup by a year. From your perspective, and because I always tell everybody about this, it was such an awesome time to be in New England in those years because every team just had so much success.
No question. Yeah, 04 was wild. We, as Bruins, blew it in the playoffs, which really sucked. But with the Red Sox winning, that was you cannot really explain it. I guess well, you can think of what the Leafs winning would be like. That's the example, and that's what happened here. It was, you know, the top blew off, not just Boston, but the entire area and the entire New England region. So it was a lot of fun. As Bruins, I'm sure you remember, there was a lot of empty buildings down here in 03, 04, 05, 06, a lot of empty seats, and that's certainly changed. So coming back here, that's been the one big difference, is that the Bruins are a real hot ticket and compete now both on the airwaves and with ticket sales with the Patriots and the other three sport teams.
And people always ask me, you know, what was it like in 04? You know, can you describe it? And you just, you hit the nail on the head. I said, the closest thing I could come is, you know, think of what would happen here if the Leafs won. And when I first got to Boston, someone said to me, the Patriots could win 5 straight Super Bowl championships, but it would never equal 1 Red Sox World Series. Did you, as a Bruin, you know, forget the win-loss and the record, but did you guys always feel like the Red Sox kind of owned the town?
No question. It was not a doubt at all in 2000 when I moved down here all the way through. And it's moved a little bit just because of how popular football just in general has become in the United States over the last 20 years. But if the Red Sox are winning and the Red Sox are in the playoffs, that's still the number one draw here in the New England area.
Andrew Raycroft, our guest on Leadoff, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Leafs last night, Razor, dominate. Like, and I want to underline that word, dominate the Winnipeg Jets for the first 40 minutes of a hockey game. And yet, in what triggers some PTSD and is in classic Leafs fashion, they give up a goal less than a minute after scoring a goal, and in the final minute of the second period to cut a 2-0 lead to 2-1, and you're going, there is no way that the Leafs should not win this game. There is no way that the Winnipeg Jets should gain even a point, i.e. get it to overtime, but lose this game. And you're up a goal heading into the third period, and you're wondering how this is all going to play out, because the Leafs have had issues in their defensive end for years. Freddie Anderson has been up, he's been down. His reputation in this city, at least on Twitter, has come into question. As a Leafs fan, you're worried. But I thought, even though Winnipeg started to push in that third period last night, Freddie stepped up. The Leafs were never, I thought, at risk of losing control of that hockey game. It was a neat and tidy 3-1 win. That team is capable of games like that. Doesn't have to be 5-0 and a big offensive blowout with big numbers and individual statistics. I think that team is capable of games like last night far more often than we've seen over the last number of years.
I agree with you. They are. When they play the way they do last night, it's not fantastical. It's not something you're not blown away by it, which means they can do it on a consistent basis. So it's a mindset, it's a focus, and it's going to be necessary playing in this Canadian division and having a season that's only 56 games, where all of these points are just so incredibly important. And we see it already, just 4 games in, you're looking at standings and, okay, a 3-point game here, a 3-point game over there, and how that affects the standings. So for the Leafs to play the way they did, hold on, you don't want to say 4 games in that they played a really important game, but I think that proves to them the way they need to play throughout the rest of the season. There's going to be hiccups in this year. You see, to your point of the scoring, you know, absolutely dominating but not being able to bury it. The same thing's happening down in Boston over the first 3 games. They've dominated the New Jersey Devils. They couldn't score. So some of these guys, it's taking a little bit of time, obviously, to get their timing going, not playing exhibition games, et cetera, these star players. So they need to find a way, like they did last night, to get that 3-1 victory. I think it's, to your point, a great win early in the season, a blueprint for how they can win more throughout the season.
So you mentioned no exhibition games. For a guy like Freddie Anderson, who, you know, Scotty and I talked about, traditionally, you know, is a slow starter. When you have no exhibition games, and for a guy who generally needs a lot of reps to get to midseason form, so, you know, how much does that affect a goaltender? And what kind of goaltender were you? Did you need all those reps to get ready for the start of a season?
I didn't need as many reps. You like to get in the game. And the other difference, though, Hazel, is the 82-game season compared to 56 game.
Fair.
And the urgency that these 56 games require, rather than, you know, when I played my 82 games, all right, if I have a couple of tough games in October, I played with Roberto Longo, another slow starter notoriously, all right, you know, I don't have to get going until November, December, and it's not going to affect my numbers. It's such a long call. This year, I'm sure Freddie and all goalies, the guys I talked to down here in Boston, they recognized that urgency was going to be right away. They might have done a little bit more in the offseason through the Christmas holidays, through the new year to be ready for this game time. So I think the goalies have had a bit of an advantage early in timing, whether it's power plays, whether it's five-on-five play, the top lines getting going throughout the league. There has been a lot of goals, but it's been kind of scrambly. It hasn't necessarily been skill from the top-end guys, and I think the goalies have had that advantage, but they have to catch up. They have to keep going, and you really have to work on your game every single day, despite the fact you're not getting a lot of practice time as goalies because there's so many games. So it's such a fine balance, and the guys that figure it out, both mentally and physically, what they need earlier and get to that point earlier, will have the most success in this shortened season.
With Andrew Raycroft, do you think the 23, 24 minutes a night that Austin and Mitch are playing right now, is Sheldon Keefe's way to get these guys' engines going? Or do you think that they could actually, given so few off days relative to most NHL seasons, do you think they could actually continue to be ridden at that pace through most of this season?
I watched the games, and I think they can. I think these guys can handle it. I think the top end guys, Connor McDavid, Matthews, Marner, I think these guys can handle those minutes. Number one, it's a lot of power play minutes, which is not taxing in any way whatsoever. So if you're getting 5, 6, 7 minutes a night on the power play, that's like gravy train for these guys. That's cake. They're not trying to grind through a plate of green beans when they're on the power play. And the other thing is it's not a physical game out there anymore. Guys aren't leaning on each other in the corners. It's so much speed. It's not a lot of stop and starting. Guys are just flying up and down the ice. So I think in that respect as well, these guys are so highly trained that they could skate for days. It's when you put bodies on them, it's when you start leaning in the corner, you lose that endurance. But watching these games, there just isn't a lot of that. So to see these guys over 20 minutes a night average, I don't think it's taxing if you're really breaking it down with those power play minutes.
All right, Rays, we're going to keep you on the line here. We've got our first virtual meet and greet contest read for a chance for a listener to sit down with Joe Thornton, an old teammate of yours. So just buckle up. I'm going to read the liner, and then we're going to ask you a question off of that. All right, so here's the deal. We're giving you the chance to virtually meet Joe Thornton, one of Razor's old teammates. Tune in every weekday for keywords, and then you text them to 590-590 to enter. The more keywords you collect, the better your odds are to win a spot in the video chat with Joe. Your first keyword comes now. Your first keyword is jumbo. Text jumbo to 590-590 right now to enter. Hear your next keyword at 12:20 during Hockey Central. For details on how to meet Jumbo Joe, visit sportsnet.ca/590. Quickly, Razor. Listener wins a virtual meet and greet with Joe Thornton. What are they hearing? Who are they talking to? Give us a shot of the personality. We got a sense of it. You know the guy.
Collect those keywords, people. That will be the Zoom of the coronavirus pandemic. There's no question about that. I mean, what you're going to get, and it was funny, we were listening to it on the radio yesterday, where the interviewer, they asked Joe about playing with Matthews and Marner, and he says, oh, I love those kids, playing with Maddie and Mitchie and that is exactly Joe. That is to a T. There's going to be nothing but laughter. He's going to have his big chuckle every other word, and it will be priceless. So collect the keywords. He has not changed in 22 years. There's no question.
Good to hear your voice, pal. We'll get you back on, and I'm sure Ziggy will emerge from the wilderness of his dining room or wherever he is, and we'll reconnect and chat soon. Thanks for this.
Great talking to you again.
You too, Hazel. Have a great day, Scotty Mac, both of you. Thanks.
Andrew Raycroft, Nesson NHL analyst, former Leafs goalie. We had Bob Costas on for 25 minutes at the top of the 7 o'clock hour. It was a pre-taped interview done yesterday. After the interview finished, we had an off-air chat with Bob about the incident in the 1989 ALCS where for about a 48-hour period, Bob was the least liked person in Toronto and maybe across Canada. And he asked at the end of the interview, have I been forgiven? Well, that led to the off-air conversation where he took us through the story.
It's a crazy story.
Costas After Hours next. Leafs neat and tidy with the Jets last night. Raptors dominate the Mavs. They're on a three-game heater. And Jared Porter fired as the general manager of the Nye Mets. I mean, he made some significant moves this offseason since taking the job, but he will never watch the team play a game while he holds the title, and rightfully so, as he was exposed for sexually harassing repeatedly via text a female reporter back in 2016 when he was in the Chicago Cubs front office, a scouting guy. And she is now out of the industry, living back in her home country, which is unnamed, and she is unnamed. And so he is out of work. And the New York Mets, it's such a weird franchise, man. There's a broader story there, right? They're all in this year with the new owner. They hired Carlos Beltran before the 2019 season, and he never managed a game for them because of his ties to the Houston cheating scandal as a player in 2017. Now this, it's just a thing.
They've always said the Mets was this dysfunctional family, but I feel like this decision was Stephen Cohen
doing the right thing.
Yeah, I think this bodes well for them, as you know, credibility wise and as you know, members of our community and our society. When you see a wrongdoing, you need to speak up. And so again, I said last hour, you know, to me, Stephen Cohen did the right thing. He did it swiftly. There was no in between. There was no humming and hawing. There was no waiting for backlash from fans. And he knew the behavior was wrong. He dealt with it. Now we can move on.
Mina Kimes, Jeff Passan on the story on ESPN.com. And if we're sitting here advocating for good journalism, this is what good journalism does. It shines light on the world's darkness. And the world's darkness can come in from a variety of different places. Unfortunately, it comes its fair share of the time from the world of sports. So, hour and a half ago, Bob Costas, and we copped. Afterward, after the fact, we copped that it was a pre-tape. Bob's out on the West Coast, so let's be honest. A live interview at 7 a.m. for Bob Costas would be a 4 a.m. wake-up call. And as lovely as you and I are, Hazel, I don't even think...
I think his exact text to me was, you would get a more alert and knowledgeable Bob Costas after 7 a.m.
If you let me sleep in.
Yes.
After 7 a.m. Pacific time.
Yes, that's right.
So we got him at 8 a.m. Pacific time, 11 a.m. Eastern time yesterday. What ended up happening was 25 minutes that you heard on the air, but Silent Vic kept running our post-show chat. You know Bob well, so he was comfortable to just sort of kick it with us for a few extra minutes. The on-the-air portion of the interview ended with him jokingly asking, have I been forgiven yet? For the 1989 American League Championship Series fiasco. And I got to be honest, I was 10.
I was in my teens.
You were in your teens. I didn't remember a lot of that. I have much more clear memories of the Canadian flag being held upside down before the World Series game in Atlanta in 92 and all the stuff that churned up. I don't really remember this, but with Bob's permission... having recorded the post-interview kind of chill off-the-record conversation, we will replay a couple of minutes of him reminding us of what happened in October of 1989.
Game two in Oakland, the A's win the first two games, and every broadcaster knows what fans can't figure out. Two things. One, network announcers are different than local announcers. They're doing it down the middle. But also, you reflect what the crowd reaction is. So if Ernie Witt hit a home run that made the score 7-2 when the Blue Jays are losing 7-2, as he's rounding the bases, it sounds closer to the 18th green at the Masters than it would if he hit that home run at Sky Dome. So everything that happened, and the A's happened to win the game, put more excitement behind the A's. So they're up by 4 runs. Eckersley comes out of the bullpen to close out game 2, and they put his stats on the screen. And I say, well, when you look at that and a 4-run deficit and 3 outs to get, Elvis has a better chance of coming back than the Blue. I meant in that inning, in that game.
Yeah.
But naturally, I become the ugly American. And when I get off the plane in Toronto, there's a whole bunch of cameramen waiting, like literally at the door of the plane. I'm walking down the jetway, pop, 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 pop. And then there's a headline in one of the Toronto tabloids, Jays hater Bob Costas disembarks in Toronto. And
wow.
Before game 3, they handed out 45,000 Bob Costas masks. And the people were holding up these Costas masks. And then when they put me and Kubek on the jumbo screen, they disregarded the fact that Tony was doing Blue Jays games then also, onto the jumbo screen, and everyone's booing and the whole thing. So now NBC security decides that I have to register under an alias. And these idiots decide that my alias is B. Johnson. Like, this is a year after Ben Johnson.
Oh, my gosh. Yes.
So during game 4, Kubek is kidding me about it. And I said, yeah. And, you know, when you feel more safe registering as Salman Rushdie, and you know things have taken a very nasty turn.
Bob Costas.
Nice laugh. For some reason, I was like, I don't think I've ever heard you laugh like that before.
I have many laughs. Apparently, I just laugh in different ways. I don't have a consistent laugh.
I vaguely remember the Bob Costas masks for some reason, but I had forgotten about the criticism. I do recall the year before, and, you know, I looked up the LA Times article on this. In 1988, Bob got himself in some hot water when he said that, you know, in game 4 of the World Series in 88, that the Los Angeles Dodgers lineup wasn't good enough to play in the World Series. So this is 1988, and then fast forward to 89, he gets into this like little controversy with Canadian baseball fans. Among them, he mentioned it, the Ernie Witt. I think one of the criticism was he wasn't as enthusiastic or as boisterous as the Henderson home run. To say that Elvis was, you know, more chance of Elvis coming back to life or something
for the Blue Jays
in
this game. Eckersley with a 4-run lead in 89.
And he meant in that inning, not right. The series.
Well, let's be honest. I mean, we don't need to do too deep a dive into history here, but Oakland was
dominant.
The better team.
Yes, definitely.
And quite frankly, the Oakland teams that made 3 consecutive World Series, 88, the loss to the Dodgers, which is best known for the Kirk Gibson home run, 89, the earthquake that they played the Giants. They had a 2-0 lead, mm-hmm. game 3 at Candlestick. Before it starts, the earth shakes, the Bay Bridge collapses, all of that crazy stuff. World Series resumes like a week later, and they sweep the Giants and won. The next year, they played Lou Piniella's Cincinnati Reds and were the better team on paper but got swept. Tony La Russa's A's, it's funny because Tony's now managing again with Chicago. They should have won by rights on paper.
A lot.
So it's why you play the games. They should have won all 3. They only won 1 of the 3, but they were clearly the better team. And the thing, and we were talking to Bob off air because mm-hmm. that was a snippet of the off air conversation. The thing we all remember about the 89 American League Championship Series, the Sky Dome was 4 months old at the time. It had opened in June of that year. To the Blue Jays, Jose Canseco became the first player to deposit a home run in the 500 level.
Monster.
The late Mike Flanagan gave it up. That was the wow moment of that series. The Jays they won game 3, but they had no chance. No chance. We always, though, whether it's the flag, our flag being carried upside down for the anthem ceremonies in Atlanta, before, I can't remember if it was game 1 or game 2, but we had our knickers in a knot about it by the time the series came back to game 3. whether it was Sean McDonough and Tim McCarver, because by then it was on CBS in 92. Oh, these guys don't like us. So we always, the Raptors, why are we playing at 12 noon? We're the best team. We got Kawhi. Why are we getting the crappy time? Why are the Blue Jays playing the Texas Rangers at a disadvantageous, if that's a word, time in the middle of the week during the division series? We're always mad. We're always mad about something. We always create a villain, whether it's a network broadcaster or a network executive.
Well, in this LA Times article that I was looking at last night, it said, you know, by the time Costas showed up at Sky Dome for Game 3 Friday, he was greeted by the following bedsheet banners. Nuke Bob Costas.
Oh, that's normal.
Costas, go home. Dear Costas, Elvis is alive. And then Costas, welcome to the kingdom. I don't get that one. Welcome to the kingdom. King?
Kingdom, like the, I don't know, the Commonwealth.
Ah, Elvis, and then the king. Vic. Thank you, Silent
Thank
Vic.
Thank you, Silent Vic. When Silent Vic talks,
it means something. It's meaningful.
Yeah. It matters.
So
he's bailed me out about 100 times on this show.
I'm glad, you know, Vic was rolling as we were talking about that. But
well, he's such a spy.
But Costas remembers the flashbulbs, the way he felt walking off the plane, seeing the headlines in Toronto. He remembers it, and it's like 30 years ago.
He should just read every nursery rhyme and every bedtime story that's ever been written, and You create the Bob Costas Reads Bedtime Stories app, and instead of parents having to put in an hour and a half to get the kids down every night, just leave the phone by the bed, sit in the room if your kid needs you in there or whatever, and just let Bob Costas read the Berenstain Bears. I'd listen to it.
It's so nice. You and I talked about how much we admire Bob, his work. He has done everything. I don't know what is left on his bucket list. I mean, he's done everything. And when you meet him, it was so nice to know he was a nice human being. Like, he was a good person, because you hold a lot of people on this pedestal, and then when you finally meet them, they turn out to be jerks and you're just so disappointed. Bob Costas is so professional. He's witty. He's very kind. He's very generous with people. You know, he doesn't walk around with his nose up in the air. He is, you know, I'm very, very, very fortunate and thankful that, you know, we have the ability to chat with him this
When you
way.
Listen to him talk, you're like, that's a dude with an IQ of about 145. Like,
1,000%.
Yeah, he's a Mensa member. He's running Mensa.
1,000%.
He created Mensa. 519 number. I don't know if this is a serious text or not, but what's the reference to B. Johnson? What happened? Because we do have younger listeners who may not know Ben Johnson, 1988 Seoul Olympics, wins the gold, pees out some stanozolol and tests positive for steroids, and the gold medal is stripped from Ben Johnson in Canada and is given to Carl Lewis of the United States. So about a year and a bit later, October of 89, Bob Costas needs to go in under an alias, and his bosses say, go in as
B. Johnson.
B. Johnson. Well, Ben Johnson. That's
no, your father, thing. You said to me in the break, your father remembers Costas talking about Ben Johnson. Did he not?
Remembers that, but remembers also, because Sky Dome ended up hosting after the 96 games. You remember in 97, the 150-meter race between Donovan Bailey, who had won the 100-meter race at the 96 Atlanta Olympics,
and Michael Johnson,
who had won the 200-meter race, and Bob Costas was part of this, but wasn't the only one. When the Americans didn't win the gold in the 100, but did in the 200, they proliferated this myth that the 200-meter winner was, in fact, the fastest
man
person in the world. Well, out of that came the event at Sky Dome in early June of 1997, where they met halfway, 150 meters. And it was going to be Donovan Bailey, Michael Johnson. Well, Michael Johnson knew he was going to get his ass kicked and pulled up lame in the middle of the race.
He's just a chicken. He's afraid to lose.
Yeah, thank you. And Donovan Bailey was spitting facts on that particular night.
It's all
friends.
Coming back. I do
right?
remember that.
So,
yeah.
But out of whether it was legitimate opinion or proliferation of American propaganda, Bob Costas was a part of it. It created the event that Skydome then held some 10 months later in June of 97, mm-hmm. featuring Bailey and Johnson.
Incredible.
Yeah, it's just, it's history. And Bob Costas has been at the forefront, I guess, of more of it here in Canada than we know, although yeah. we just kind of fleshed some of it out.
Good guest.
We'll tell you who's coming up on Good Show. We had Bob Costas this morning. They got a good one coming up in the 11 o'clock hour. We'll tell you who it is on the other side. Brent Burns on Tim and Sid at 6:30. Swami Chris Berman.
Wow.
On Good Show at 11:30. So a little Costas this morning, a little Berman in about a little more than two and a half hours here on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
He could go on the way.
Some awesome nicknames through the years. You know, it's funny, Eric Bieniemy, who is the offensive coordinator of your favorite football team, yes. the Kansas City Chiefs.
When you said that, I'm like, where is he going with this?
Who is a well-deserving and past deserving of a head coaching job. The problem is it's harder to interview, of course, when your team is
when we're always
going
in
into the AFC
Super Bowl
championship
what?
Game each what? And every year. But Berman would always have awesome nicknames for guys. Sean Landetta, the old punter for the New York Giants. Sean Personal Landetta. Personal Vendetta, right? And Eric was, remember the old movie Sleeping with the Enemy? So he'd run the football for the San Diego Chargers. They'd be showing highlights, him and Tom Jackson on NFL primetime on Sunday nights. Eric sleeping with the enemy. Rushed for 110 yards on 18 carries as the Chargers beat the Broncos or whatever, right? Like just classic nickname stuff. Anyway, that's one that always.
How come when I do that in an update, you guys hammer on me?
Well, because Hugh, how much fun would it be if it? I mean, if we actually paid you compliments.
Because the ones I come up with are stupid.
What are you here to make you believe like you're good at your job? Constant negative reinforcement yeah. is the way to go about getting the most out of people.
I love
don't
when he
you
does
know this?
The,
Haven't you learned yet?
I love when he does the back at the home run derby.
Home run derby. Yeah.
That's cute the first time and the second time. Usually by the third round, it's like, okay.
Yeah, okay, enough.
All right. It's just the soundtrack to our lives. Yeah. Hey, back.
Yeah, frozen rope that just gets over the fence. Yeah. Back.
But what a career he's carved out. So Ben and JD will have him on at 11:30, and there will be football talk in there as well. You're making fun of my laugh at the end of that Bob Costas take there.
It didn't sound like.
Yeah. What was that? So we've had that. We've also had this. And we've also had this. through the months on this show.
You're
That's
all over
you?
The map. Yeah.
I don't have a laugh. I haven't nailed. Here I am 41 and a half years into my life, and I haven't nailed down a laugh yet.
Hugh, you know who Maria Menounos is.
I think so.
She's the entertainment reporter. Anyway, she's someone from Boston.
Okay.
And I met her personally at the Super Bowl in Phoenix. And she was wearing a Patriots jersey, and I was interviewing her because she was local. And I approached her, and I asked her a quick question. And it was a great interview. And then afterwards, I said something funny, and she started laughing this awkward, and I was just like, oh my gosh. It just didn't fit. Like the laugh didn't fit her. She's gorgeous. She's just, you know, she's well-spoken. And then I made her laugh and it was like, I was just oh my gosh.
Scotty, isn't there a Seinfeld about the laugh as well? The bad.
Yeah.
Of course. See?
Jerry looks back and is like, what? This date is over. This show is over.
Alrighty.
We are back at 6 o'clock tomorrow morning to get you started on your hump day. Ben and JD have Good Show with Chris Berman as a guest. Coming up, enjoy your Tuesday. After Hours with Bob Barker. If you